Numbers of Mayor's Bread has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's Live Full report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABread.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horseville.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back. Hour two, about 5 minutes in. And as we mentioned at the top of the show, boy, we're back broadcasting for 3 days. And we've had two brilliant horsemen to pay tribute to. And now a favorite of many, many fans and players, Da Haas, at age 30 at the horse park. And only one place to go to pay tribute, and that's to Michael Dickinson, who joins us now. Michael, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
I told everybody, even under the circumstances, it's always a pleasure to be able to connect with you. And I thought I was going to see you at Arizona at the symposium, but you didn't make it with a Tapita stand, as it were, you know, for the trade show. Yeah.
Well, I'll try and make it next year, Steve.
Outstanding. We'll talk about Tapita and get some surface conversation in as well with you this morning. But talk about Da Haas, Michael, and what he means to you.
Well, first of all, he lived to be 30, which is quite old for thoroughbred.
Sure.
And he's had a great life. He was well looked after here, and the people at the horse park looked after him very well. And the good news is he didn't suffer. He went quickly. So we're all relieved about that. People say he didn't run a lot. Well, that's rubbish. I mean, yes, he didn't run much in his last season because we missed 2 years. But he ran three times as a two-year-old, and he ran 11 times as a three-year-old in quite a few, the Jersey Derby, the Ohio Derby, the Hollywood Derby, the Swaps, all sorts, and the Del Mar Derby. So he ran a lot as a three-year-old, and even next year he ran five times as a four-year-old. And of the top 15 three-year-olds in his year, only one other horse won a race as a four-year-old, and he won the Breeders' Cup. So that was great. So he'd already achieved a lot. Yes, we gave him a year off, which he had to have. So he came back at six, and he only ran twice. But he'd already run a lot more than most horses. That's that.
There's so many interesting elements to his career and the way in which he ended up garnering the following he did. The work you put into him once he came to you, you talk about the evaluation and deciding that he needed opportunities on the grass, and you alternated for quite a while during that busy 30-year-old's campaign.
Yes, he did. And at the end of his four-year-old career, we were still debating which to go, but we took him, I said, down to Laurel to breeze on the dirt track, and he was terrible. He just couldn't handle it anymore. As you know, he's got had spurs on his hocks, and as they got older, they got worse. So it was a no-brainer at the end. He had to go on the grass. But a bit of a problem training him was because he always wanted to go out and give them hell. If he was a human, you'd say to him, "Now, just, if you don't feel too good, just go steady, just go steady." But he always wanted to give them hell in the breezes. So he never looked after himself. So John Boy, who used to ride him, used to look after him. But it made him a bit difficult. It was his own worst enemy. He was too brave.
To some degree, it's still a good quality to have. When did he come to you during that winter after the two-year-old season was over in Arizona?
Yes, he came to us, I think, January, very early January of his three-year-old career. Yes.
And you know, the backstory for that two-year-old season, Kevin Eichelberry and Wall Street Racing, they owned him and obviously caught the attention of the Prestons.
Right, exactly, yes. Yes, they did. And then he was actually sold before that, but he failed the vet.
Wow.
Somebody else, a big owner from New York, bought him, but he failed the vet. So then Dr. Baker from Kentucky went to see him, and he failed him as well, but he said, "I think you should have him." So well done to him.
When you evaluated him, you know, as a newly turned three-year-old, I mean, what were your thoughts? Because, you know, you tried him.
Yeah, Joan saw him breed just once and said, "This is a really good horse." We hadn't got to see him twice. Joan picked him out, and he was Joan's horse, really.
Wow.
He was closest to him. That was my wife and the assistant trainer. When he retired, Joan would take John Boy, his exercise rider, and Miguel, our barn former, to go and see him on regular occurrences. But it was a highly charged and emotional experience. It was who was going to cry first, because they all loved him so much. And then they, you know, about choked him with carrots. yes. But he was Joan's horse, really, more than mine.
The series of victories as a 3-year old, and it became increasingly obvious, you know, with wins in the Jersey Derby, and then the Del Mar Derby, and it became clear that that he was going to have a turf future, and yet at the end of the year. Michael, you ran him in the Pegasus at Meadowlands. It came up sloppy, and then cut him back sort of precisionist style in the sprint. But that was pretty much the end of the road for the main track.
Yes. We wanted to go in the Breeders' Cup Mile at Belmont, but I walked the track a week before, and it was very soft indeed, very soft, and it was going to rain all week. There's no chance. He didn't like soft going. So we thought we'd try him on the dirt, going sprinting. That was his only chance of a race. But, yes.
Well, and of course he had won, you know, the race that people probably forgot until reviewing his career, that he won the best turn going three quarters on the aqueduct on the old inner course.
Yes, he did, yes. Yes, he was a fast horse.
Yeah.
He had lots of speed. He used to love going out with his best friend, Boomer, when he was here at the farm. He used to go out in a grass field, several grass fields for him, because we were always changing him so the grass was fresh. But it turned out for about 3 hours a day. And that was, I think, very important for him. It helped to keep him mentally, because he was quite keen. It helped to get fresh air into his lungs. He loved the grass, and it helped him to move around. So that was, I think, a big part of his success, that he had 3 hours a day in a nice grass paddock with his best friend, Boomer.
Michael, the last couple of seasons, everybody talks about between 96 and 98, but frankly, there was an extended layoff after the Hollywood Derby try. Labib beat him in the Hollywood Derby after that Breeders' Cup sprint. He was not back for 6 months when he came back for the poker. So he had had another, fairly extensive break even before that. Really, two of them.
Yes, it wasn't that long, but yes, you're quite correct. But he ran well in the poker. Poker was a great stake, and I think he ran third.
He did, with Cornelio.
Exactly. Yeah. No, he ran all right. He never let us down.
Came to Saratoga. The one time he came to Saratoga, certainly, the four-star Dave win.
That was ridiculous, that was. The four-star Dave, Ben, was, I think, about 70 or 80,000 to the winner. It was a ridiculous race at the time when we had $100,000 allowance races. So I said to Billy Mott going out, I said, anybody who runs a horse in this race needs a head examining by a really good man. Because there were 13 horses that all won graded stakes. And the race was about 75 grand. We won and Billy was second. I said, it was two idiots, you and me and the rest of us.
I'm going to let me pull up the chart. Here was that field. DeHaas with Johnny aboard. And you were second choice, 4-1. Green Means Go with Jerry Bailey for Bill Mott and Pin Oak. Then Rare Reason, Jambalaya Jazz, Debonair Dan, Dumani, Kiri's Clown, Mighty Forum, My Mogul, Dove Hunt, Grand Continental with Mig, Marcy's Ensign, and Signal Tap. Signal Tap was a nice horse for Scotty, right? Yeah.
There were 13 graded stakes horses in one race. Was that ridiculous?
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. That Debonair Dan jumps out at me. That was a horse of Gary's, Siaka's, that was very nice, Debonair Dan. And he was fifth in there. You're right. This was some race. This is one of those races that time forgot. And let's see, $100,000 added grade three. So you brought home $71,000 for it. That you're not wrong on that front. Went to Penn National. You won the Governor's Cup. And then he was off just a little bit. Lead into that first Breeders' Cup win. Gary Stevens rode him in the Kelso and just got beat. Came back and wins the first Breeders' Cup.
Right, yes.
And I'm just looking, 8-1 in that first Breeders' Cup. So even though he really had had a very solid year, Spinning World he beats in there, and he beat the horse that beat him in the Kelso, same old Wish.
Yeah. Well, you see, he'd only just won at Penn National, and he didn't win the Kelso, he was only third. And there were some top Europeans. Mark of Esteem was the short prize favorite in the Woodbine Breeders'
Wow.
Cup. And he was taking all the money, and he was all the talking horse. So anything else would be a bit longer.
Huh. And now take us through, post Woodbine and the time off. You and I have talked about this before.
The following year, he was training in January in South Carolina, and he got a tendon. Now, it wasn't a bad tendon, but tendons take a long time to recover. If you have a chip on a bone, you can get in about 3 months. But tendons take a lot longer. So it took a long time for him to come back. So we gave him the whole year off, and we brought him back in January. And he was training in June, and he came up with a tendon again. So that was a dreadful phone call I had to make to the owners. I said, I know you haven't seen this horse now for over a year, but I'm going to ask for more time. So if you give me more time, we'll get him there. Anyhow, we sort of muddled away on, and about 6 weeks, 8 weeks before the Breeders' Cup, two bets saw him and said, look, you won't make the first race, let alone the second race. So it was very depressing, very worrying. And, sorry, I just lost my train of thought there, yes. So, yes, they said he, and two bets said he wouldn't make it. But my barn foreman, Miguel Piedra, came to me and said, don't you worry, Michael, we'll get him there. And he did. He said, he runs not with his legs, he runs with his heart. So that was that.
Well, and you did get the prep in, and I think maybe people forget that there was a race. In fact, our friend Nick Hahn in Virginia, he sent me a text to say, you know, don't forget the allowance prep with John's Call, which was enough of a performance to earn De Haas a race named after him at Colonial.
Yes, that was just a $10,000 allowance race. And with two grade one winners, because John's Call went on to win a grade stake, didn't he?
Absolutely.
So that was tough for 10 grand.
Unbelievable.
So, John Boy gets a lot of the credit. If you remember at Churchill there, it's Tom Durkin said, and the Hoss fights back, because he'd made the lead and Hawks the Hill passed him and he was half a length down. But he fought back. And that was De Haas, but it also a little bit for John Boy. John Boy was his exercise rider. And every time we'd breeze him, we'd breeze him over half a mile. He'd set off five lengths behind the other horses because he was so much better than them. And with a furlong to go, he would always just move up. But the first two furlongs, he was like me at a red light. He didn't like it, but he knew he had to stay there. But anyhow, coming into the last furlong, John Boy would let him cruise up to within half a length of the other horses he was breezing against. And then right at the last moment, he used to just let him go and nail the other people on the wire. And he did that lots of times, like 10, 12 times. So John Boy taught him to win, gave him the confidence, and he would always do that lurch. He always knew where the wire was, and he always did that lurch, and he always wanted to nail him at the wire.
We're going to listen to the race in a second. Michael Dickinson with us to celebrate the incredible career of De Haas. And, Michael, one thing I mentioned this morning, just sort of top-lining his career, he gave his all for anybody in the irons. It's unbelievable how many different riders got on him, and he was competitive for everybody.
Yes, he was. Yes. He was a trier, bless him.
Now, Johnny ends up getting him for his final start, and Johnny V actually rode him twice in that four-star, Dave. And how did that conversation come about? That did you shop around, or was Johnny tracking him?
Right. Well, what had happened in the middle of the season, Johnny had ridden another horse for the Prestons, trained by another trainer. And Johnny was coming back after injury. And he'd had trouble with his shoulder, and he couldn't hold this other horse. So the Prestons were a bit down on Johnny. We wanted Johnny. And it was Angel Cordero kept persevering. And we wanted Johnny, but we couldn't go against the owners. But eventually, you know, there was nobody else left. And we wanted Johnny. They'd had a little bit of a misunderstanding back in the summer with their other horse. But it all went well.
We're going to listen to it. What was your thought? I mean, did you feel he was right enough to, obviously, to compete? But how confident were you that you were going to get an A race from him?
We were very confident indeed. We thought he was better than he'd been the year before.
Wow.
2 years before. We were very confident that he was in top form. yes.
I love it. Here it is. And not only is it one of the most famous races in Breeders' Cup history or otherwise, it also ends up as one of Tom Durkin's absolute legendary calls. Michael Dickinson and the Prestons de Haas with John Velasquez in the 98 Breeders' Cup Mile, his final career start.
We're ready for the start of the Breeders' Cup Mile, and they are off. Favorite Trick was off to a sharp start and goes right out after the lead. Among Man is also right there. Here comes Fly to the Stars, and he's flying toward the front to engage Favorite Trick as they move for the first turn. By the Stars, Favorite Trick will vie for the early lead. Among Men tucks in behind them, running in third. Kate Cross hugs the hedge and saves Precious Brown on the first turn. He's in fourth position. Long-legged Military is fifth on the outside. He's only about 5 lengths from the early lead. 96 Winner De Haas is running sixth toward the rails. Wire Dancer is running in seventh. Favorite Prince in and among horses is eighth. Second Empire, ninth toward the inside. Wacky Now is asked to run midway down the back stretch. Labib is still a bit unhurried. He's about 9 or 10. 10 lengths from the lead, then Mr. Lightfoot followed by Magellan. Hawksley Hill has trailed throughout. The pace 46 and 2 for the opening half mile. A testing pace here as the field goes into the far turn. On the outside, Kate Cross, a short lead. Among Men toward the inside. Reigning Horse of the Year, Favorite Trick is right there. And Pat Day is moving with Favorite Trick. As they approach the top of the stretch, they are in front, the short lead. Flight of the Stars is just in behind them, and a host of pursuers are coming on. De Haas is in with the chance on the outside. Second Empire, Hawksley Hill is now coming hard. Labib is finding his best front length. Play your dancer on the outside, nothing up for Favorite Trick. It is De Haas and Hawksley Hill. Huxley Hill and De Haas. Huxley Hill finds a short lead. De Haas is game as they come. Coming down to the line. Spine tingles straight back. De Haas comes back. Unbelievable. Sensational. In victory here today. It was very, very close with Huxley Hill. Oh, my. This is the greatest comeback since Lazarus. He had one race in 2 years. The winner of the 96 mile comes back, and it is an apparent victory. It looked like he got it over the narrowest of margins from a game, Hawksley Hill.
There it is. Michael, just unbelievable.
Yes. Yes. As we said, he's the horse of a lifetime, and that was a race of a lifetime. But it was great.
One of the, you know, and obviously then, you know, let's see, he's been, that was 98. I think he came to the, horse park in 2000, I think, fairly quickly.
Yeah, and he was very happy there. They looked after him well. He had a good retirement. And 30 is very old for Furbet.
Sure.
So he's had a good innings, but we'll still all miss him.
When was the last time you saw him, Michael?
I saw him last year. I haven't been to Lexington this year. I saw him last year.
Nice.
But we have lots of people who send us photos of him all the time. Yes.
Well, and how I'm guessing how often when you talk to horse players and fans and people do they bring him up to you? He seems like he's got he was a horse that garnered tremendous following and fan base.
Yes, he did. Yes,
I love it. Well, brilliant job, Michael. It's
Well, he was a high-class horse, and he was a very genuine horse. He always gave his all. He never let us down.
Let me, before we, I ask you about Tapita and some updates, got to mention that you're running at some horses at Turfway, and I see you got a maiden coming out later this week on Friday night, My Brother Cam.
Yes, ran third on the turf. And we ran him on the dirt, which he hated. So, but he's better on the Tapita, so we're just hoping for the best.
This is one of Mr. Horton's Malibu Moon Colt, a nice 3-year-old. Yeah.
Yes, a lovely. He's well bred and good looking. So, looking forward to him on Friday.
Excellent. And how many right now you have in training?
I have 7 in training, and that's all I want. I'm very happy. Just. I'm very close to my horses. I got up at 4 o'clock all summer to turn them all out because it was a hot summer. So I get up at 4, I feed them at 4:30 and turn them all out at 4:45 so they could have 3 hours in a paddock before it got too hot.
Hmm.
So I'm close to my horses. It's the way I like it. Got some good owners, and they lead me to it, and that's great. I've got some for George Strawbridge, Augustine Stable,
yep,
and Mrs. Brody from Gallagher Farm. So, yes, I'm really happy.
Very nice. When do we see Royne again?
Royne will run with blinkers on next time. So he runs in about a week's time.
Nice. Was a nice maiden winner in New York, actually, going back to November for Mr. Strawbridge. This is a Ghost Zapper out of a very nice mare, right? That Safe Crossing?
Yes.
Yeah, she was all right.
But his other horse he has with us, Etheric, is better than Royne.
Okay.
He's a three-year-old Etheric. She was second in New York.
And, nice.
Only third last week at Turfway, but she got murdered at the furlong pole. But, so she's going to be better than Royne.
Interesting. All right, so we'll watch.
Theodora B.
Yes. The nice stake winner from a couple of years ago.
Exactly, yes.
Would she got a foal to deliver this winter, this spring?
Yes, I think so. I think she was in foal to Quality Road.
Very nice. Very nice. Well, Michael Dickinson with us to celebrate the Haas, but you can't have Michael Dickinson without some surface conversation. Michael, what are your thoughts on where things are and the Tapeta surface at Gulfstream? I'm sure you're monitoring that. Give us an update on the surface.
Well, it's been a good year for Tapeta. At Presque Isle, we had no fatalities, training or racing.
Wow.
So that was good because some of those horses come off less than perfect dirt tracks in the winter. So some of them, when they arrive at Presque Isle, aren't that sound. So they've had a good year there. Gulfstream was a bit slow when it opened, and we got criticised for it by people who don't know what they're talking about. Yes, it was a bit slow, but it had only been down for 10 days. With the supply crisis, and in the perfect world, Gulfstream should have been closed down while we rebuilt the track. But we rebuilt it during racing, which has never been done before. So it was hard to do, and we were a bit late putting it down with various delays. But we kept the Stronach Group should be commended for keeping the show on the road while they were building the carry on racing while they were building the track. So it was a bit slow to begin with. It hadn't had any rain. Anyhow, it's quickened up now. But the people who criticised it should have realised that it had only been down for 10 days. And our other tracks, Woodbine is quite quick at times. Anyhow, after about 2 or 3 weeks, it was riding quicker. But some of the jockeys and the trainers went to the state vet and said, look, we don't want it too fast. Who cares about the speed? All we want is safety. And where it was then was about right. They said, we don't want to break records. We just want Evers the safest.
Sure.
So I know some of the handicappers like rock hard tracks, but we just want the safest track. But it's doing well. They've had more runners there on the Tapeta than they have on the dirt. And they've been betting quite well on it.
What conversations is there prospect for any other new installations?
Well, we've just opened the track in December at Southwell in England, near Nottingham. It was actually Robin Hood country, and there were 150 entries one day. Most of them got planted out, and we could only run 94 in one day. So it's been a huge success. That's in England. What's going to happen over here? Well, my wife deals with all that. But there are 2 or 3 tracks in the pipeline, but it's not definite yet.
And of course, you and Joan work tirelessly at constantly evaluating and you know, trying to make the surface as good as it can be in terms of durability and well, safety and every element.
Yeah, Joan is 95% of it. She does it all. And she's, you know, she developed the Tapeter 10 because it was 10 improvements from mine. And now she's gone up to Tapeter 12, and she gets better every year. So, yeah, that's her baby.
Well done. Well done. Michael, as always, even under these circumstances with the passing of DeHasi, give always a great visit, the opportunity to catch up with you on any topic, and always prepared to craft out another DeHasi if the raw material comes your way.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you very much.
Michael Dickinson and Tapeter Footings, of course. When it comes to celebrating DeHasi's life, I'm sure there's many listening that he was their favorite or the horse that when they became fans, he was the one. And I'm sure a lot of you visited him at the horse park. And he'll be buried at the horse park the Walk of, I think, the Walk of Champions. Is that the... I think that's what they call it, DeHasi. Always great to talk to Michael, and always fun to listen to the Durkin call. It's you can hear the surprise in Durkin's voice. Pretty funny. We'll turn to Sid Fernando, Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hillandale. It was a good weekend for Hillandale this past weekend, and we've got a handful of... handful of topics, actually, for Sid, including, I haven't mentioned, as part of the post, you know, the post-holiday period, the passing of Dan Seeley. See if Sid wants to dive into that. But we will... catch up on a few things. I'm just reaching through the stack of material. We'll certainly let Sid sound off on Seattle SLU and his influence, which went beyond obviously the racetrack. And also, I printed out this morning, I haven't had a chance to read it, but Sid's Taking Stock column at TDN looks really interesting, talking about Cairo and Vaguely Noble. So I want to ask him about that as well. And what else I had? I had a couple more things for Sid that piled up. Now they're probably covered up by this week. It doesn't take long for the old to be covered up by the new. Oh, we'll ask him about, there's Ron Bauer. We got to ask him about how he recommends the Fradkins handle that situation. I'm going to mention, I brought up Shinny, the winningest horse of 2021, those 12 wins, and our friend Leslie Knopf pointed out that he runs today in the sixth at Turf Paradise. Yeah. 3:08 Mountain Time. So 5:08 Eastern in a 1 mile event, even money with Lindy Wade. There's a great picture. There's that great picture that you may have seen with the story about Shinny. I think it was in the Blood Horse, or was it in TDN? That with Lindy Wade, he's got a big smile, and he's holding up, 10 fingers for the 10 straight wins. So if you want to take an interest in this streaking Square Eddie gelding, it was out of an Indian Charlie mare. So, all right. Sid, do we have Sid? Sid is saying to call him on the other phone. Let me give it to you.
No, I'm here now.
There you are. Okay.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. Off the line with Michael Dickinson, which is always entertaining. How well do you know Michael?
I know him pretty good. Yeah.
We
talked and, good guy.
I missed him. I was so looking. One of the things I said going into the trip to Tucson was I was looking forward to seeing him, and he bypassed this year, but he said it sounded like he'll be at Symposium next year.
He's a quirky character, but an eccentric guy in all good ways. Very interesting to talk to. Yeah.
Well, I've got any number of things, Sid, that was piling up during the time off. Let me say happy New Year and hope the holiday period, even though we talked yesterday. This is the more formal visit.
Yeah, I forgot we talked yesterday. Yeah, that was a great show. I liked it.
Thank you so much for it because I just wanted to catch everybody up. I think it's going to be a wait and watch scenario from here, but you know it doesn't take long, Sid, for stories to supersede some of the things that happened as recently as last week. The passing of Billy Turner has got Seattle SLU conversation, and I suppose his syndication and his stud career, really is something that, you were watching, closely. You were young and just getting going. But talk about what Slew's influence became.
Well, I mean, I was just such a, the second Triple Crown winner of that decade. At 77 after Secretariat, it was just such an incredible time. And, what was really interesting about SLU was, unlike a lot of other horses during that period, he was very lightly raced at two. He only had three starts and I think only one stake, the Champagne.
Yep.
So he was very lightly raced. And immediately you noticed that this guy, Billy Turner, who, I was just getting to know at that time, was very, very attuned to his own horse. And, Slu had been, a baby Huey. He'd been a big, angry horse. He was only a 17,500 yearling. And, he handled him in such a way, with such an expert handling of the horse. Steve handled him very much like an individual and got the best out of him and never really squeezed him. And so when you go back to this, when you now flip to the three-year-old season, he just brought this horse through the, the first undefeated Triple Crown winner, brought him through that season in such an, such an incredible way. And what's really interesting about Billy Turner is he really was very concerned about this horse. You could see. He loved that horse and the way he handled him. And he did not want to go to California after the Triple Crown.
No.
And, of course, that's when J.O. Tobin beat him. And, that was it was shortly after that that who was it?
Doug Peterson.
Doug Peterson, right. And of course, there's a great story about the SLU crew nursing Seattle SLU back to health and whatnot. But the Billy Turner part was just absolutely fantastic, because I just distinctly remember at that time, you know, watching the way he handled the horse. And that was such a big part to SLU's success, in my opinion. And, of course, Seattle SLU went on to become such a great stallion, too, you know.
From a stallion standpoint, what talk about that, because it was a $12 million, I think, was the syndication.
Right. Yeah, that sounds about right. And I mean, he was, you know, such a great stallion from the get go, and he. You know, obviously, his line has come down through the years through his great son, A.P. Indy. And, you know, when we talk about Tappet, sometimes we forget that Tappet is, you know, a male line ancestor of Seattle SLU. Correct, you know. Tappet is his own stallion, and we just think Tappet, right? Sometimes you have to look at the pedigree and say, oh, my God, yeah, of course. You know, Tappet, Pulpit, AP Indy, Seattle SLU. And, yeah, I mean, it's really fascinating, because Seattle SLU was really a dirt horse. It was, and actually, when you think about Seattle SLU, too, you have to remember that he was a male line ancestor of Bull Ruler, you know, so it's a Nash Ruler, Bull Ruler line that's still continuing through Tappet. And that was, you know, one of the great lines, obviously. The Phipps' Bull Ruler was, you know, a tremendous stallion. And, of course, Bull Ruler, the knock against him for many years was that he couldn't get a Derby winner. Then he did get one with Secretariat.
You know, it's funny too, as you say that, in Champions, the 70s section, Seattle SLU is, you know, alphabetically is listed right above Secretariat. So you've got their careers next to each other, and looking at the sire line and, you know, knowing, you know, what went on subsequently, it is pretty interesting that, you know, SLU had the influence on the male front, and Secretariat really, his greatest influence came as a broodmare sire. And it just shows you, it's an interesting, you know, parallel that they're, you know, historically they're always going to be in, you know, that way alphabetically, and you know, how their racetrack exploits and how their, you know, how their post race careers went in the shed and how they live on today.
Now, it's a really interesting thing about Seattle SLU that a lot of people, here's one really interesting thing about Seattle SLU and Secretariat is, I mentioned to you that Secretariat won the Triple Crown and 73 was the son of Bold Ruler. Well, Seattle SLU is also a Bold Ruler son through Bold Reasoning, Bold Nesian, son of Bold Ruler. They were both bred, both Seattle SLU and Secretariat were bred on this great nick, which is Bold Ruler with Prince Quillo. And if you look at Seattle SLU's bottom side, his dam was My Charmer, who was by Poker, a son of Round Table, a son of Prince Quillo. So both of them were Bold Ruler, Prince Quillo crosses. And the other thing that a lot of people don't know about Seattle SLU was he was bred by Ben Castleman. However, he was bred on the advice of Seth Hancock of Claiborne. Claiborne stood Bold Reasoning. He was a very fast son of Bold Nesian. And Seth Hancock is the one who advised Ben Castleman, the Breeders' mare, their bold reasoning.
Amazing. As you mentioned, a very modest purchase. Steve Askin reposted his Seattle Slough piece that I think he wrote when Slough passed, and it talks about the purchase and how Dr. Hill had to come back to New York and couldn't stay at the sale, but had you know, reminded the tailors how much they liked this yearling. And, you know, they almost paused and they weren't going to go past 13 or 14,000. And, under Karen's urging, they continued on to 17 and change. But it, as Rich Migliori said on Monday with us, And as you can see by that, you know, by that early portion of his career, the one turn races, you know, the maiden win at Belmont, the allowance win in the Champagne, and then the 7/8 allowance to start the 3-year-old season at Hialeah. He was really fast, and Rich really drove home the point that him crushing that white rammer, who was strictly a sprinter, what he did, you know, the fact that Billy Turner was able to kind of calm him down and get him to harness his speed, you know, that's the story here, to then, you know, go on and the Flamingo, the Wood, and then the Triple Crown.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right, because, you know, his sire, Bold Reasoning, stood at Claiborne, but he was one of the cheaper horses at Claiborne. And Bold Reasoning only sired, I think, 3 crops, before he died. Seattle Slough was from his first crop, but Bold Reasoning was a, you know, he set a Belmont track record, I think, like 108 and change. He was a fast, really fast horse. So speed was the name of the game, and that's what Seattle Slough had. And really, one of the most this, you know, race I'm about to mention is, to me, one of the most memorable Seattle Slough races, and it's a race he lost. And that's the race where he was in a field with Affirmed and Exceller, and he ran the first 6 furlongs, if memory serves correct, in 109 and change, and then held off Exceller at 1.5 miles to lose in a photo finish. That's the race where Affirmed saddle slipped. I think it must have been the Woodward, or maybe it was the Jockey Club Gold Cup.
When Exceller beat him, it was the Gold Cup.
Yeah, it was the Exceller beat him in the Gold Cup, and it was 1.5 miles, and this was after Seattle Slough was involved in a furious early part of the race, and to run those kind of fractions and still stay around at the end was, and just lose it, by the way, was just an unbelievable, race. And I was actually there at that race.
Wow.
And I, you know, I told you my favorite horse of all time was Forgo. And, you know, Forgo is a horse, when I think about it, to this day, I still get goosebumps thinking about some of his races. But if you take the Forgo races out, the only real race that, in my memory, I can think about that has that similar effect to Seattle Slough's loss in that race, because after that loss, I mean, his reputation just, as big as it was, and this was in his comeback year, it just blew up even more. I mean, that was just such a phenomenal race.
You know, it's interesting, you mentioned the 109, and it was 109 and 2.
Yeah.
There were two occasions. Actually, I take that back. There were 3 occasions where he did get beat, where a sub 110 proved to be a little bit too much. There was that Gold Cup. He also got beaten the Patterson Handicap by Dr. Patches.
Yeah, he was carrying 134 pounds in that race, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, yeah, a little less, but it, 128. Dr. Patches. Dr. Patches was 114. Got in.
Yeah, that's
you know,
right.
Got in on a feather, and he. And of course, actually, he never was involved in the swaps. He was dull as can be in that swap. You know,
right,
Haskin.
Yeah.
Well, well, it's not just that. Actually, Haskin has a story in that story that Steve reposted.
Mm-hmm.
There's an incident, Sid, that I was unfamiliar with. They had signed Seattle Slew up for a Xerox commercial. A scan machine that Xerox produced, and he had to be tranquilized, I think, three times and go across the street at Belmont to the hospital to where the machine was for photo op. And Turner maintains at the time that it was dulling him. I mean, to have him tranked like that three, maybe even four times.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a.
I never knew about that.
Either did I. I had never seen that. And Steve has got a fabulous, long, long backstory that you know. Steve is nobody kept notes. I mean, he's got file cabinets of notes like this on things like that. And it's on Facebook. I saw it last night and. Read about half of it and the rest this morning, and that jumped out at me as a contributing factor to how dull he was in swaps. Plus, they took him up to Long Acres to parade him as well.
Oh my God! Yeah,
yeah. Probably put him on a van and drove him up to Washington.
Yeah, I mean that was all stuff that Billy Turner never wanted to.
Correct.
You know, yeah. have anything to do with. That's interesting to know. Yeah.
There's a bunch of things, Sid, that may have to wait a little bit till next week, but Ron Bauer's retirement. Maybe the Fradkins have called you. Maybe, I don't know, but what do you think John should do at this point with Ron Bauer, basically right on top of the start of a breeding season? How should he deal with this?
Well, I mean, I haven't heard about a farm yet. Have you?
No, because they were expecting to campaign, and his ankle, he's having an ankle issue that was what he got laid up for. And
right.
John had an interesting thought, which was, maybe going to Australia for the off season, and then, having time because he doesn't want to, try to. Slapdash a book of mares at this point, and waste his, waste what could be a very productive, you want to get the best mares in the first year.
Yeah. No, it's tough when you have to go to stud late like this. And, a lot of mares are already booked.
So exactly.
It's going to be tough to get, better mares at any price. Level is tough at this point. He's the son of Twirling Candy, and he's a classic winner. He's going to have some appeal, no question about it. Particularly, with the way the Candy Ride line has been doing, with Candy Ride's son, obviously Gun Runner, who's bred pretty much the same way. Which is Candy Ride over Giant's Causeway, and that's how this horse is bred, too. He's by Twirling Candy out of a Cowboy Cal mare. Cowboy Cal is the son of Giant's Causeway. So, there's a lot of promising elements there. And, it's a dilemma, I just had this conversation with Mr. Fripke about a horse. He was thinking about retiring. He said the same thing, you know. You're going to get really hammered at this point in time in terms of getting mares. So, you know, I guess if they do send a horse, you know, that's been done before. Horses like have been retired and then started off in the southern hemisphere. And, you know, Animal Kingdom might have been that way, too. It might have started off in the southern hemisphere and then come here for the next northern hemisphere breeding season. So if they have that type of interest from the southern hemisphere, that's a really good way to go, I think.
John has made one smart move after another with Ron Bauer, so we wish them the best. A couple of other quick hits. The end of 2021, Gunrunner, record-breaking year as a stallion, and certainly, you know, once the calendar turned, Sid, there's no stopping Gunrunner, another handful of winners, and it was certainly a good holiday weekend, holiday period for Not This Time, who sent out the winners of both the Gunrunner and the Untappable at Fairgrounds, and that Mucho Macho Man looks like a nice horse. Simplification. So Not This Time, and I think Chris McGrath just wrote a piece, actually, right? One of his value sire stories. He lauded Not This Time, how he has continued to produce.
Yeah, Not This Time is, you know, we actually did the mating for Not This Time. You know, he's a half-brother to Liam's Map, who we did the mating for,
yeah,
for the Alba Family Trust. And Not This Time is a stallion that, once again, you know, people talk about these lightly raised horses. Well, he only made four starts, and he won two of them. And even though he ran second in, you know, really good second in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile, he went to stud with only a grade three win on his resume. And look at what he's done. He started off at $15,000, and he has been absolutely lights out. And, you know, what we're seeing right now are the cheaper stud fee foals, and look how well they're doing. And now his stud fee, I think, is up to $45,000. And, you know, he's a really, really promising stallion and could be very important as the, you know, as subsequent crops come out. I think you're going to see that. He just regularly gets stakes winners, you know. And it's funny because you saw this kind of development. I'm not going to say he's going to do this because it's rare to do, but when Into Mischief was starting out and coming along, the first thing you noticed about Into Mischief was how many stakes winners he was getting. And then as he started getting better mares, they started becoming, you know, graded stakes winners, then the grade one stakes winners. Then in his particular case, you know, he was really getting speed horses, and then he started, you know, then he got a Derby winner in Authentic. So that's kind of progression you watch, and you can see a similar type of thing taking place with Not This Time. Just a lot of stakes winners.
Yeah, to have those three over the, you know, basically between, that was between the 26th and Saturday, in a week.
You also mentioned No Home you wanted to talk to me about.
I did, actually, and I didn't know if we had time, but I do have the picture of No Double. That was so much fun with Dash yesterday.
Yeah, that was a great conversation.
Celebrating Bert Sommier.
And what happened with him was, and this is what Dash wanted to talk to you about in another episode, but his dad, Gene Goff, who was in the oil business, he had business in Australia, and he ended up buying like a group of 41 horses from Australia to ship to the United States. And in that group was Nohom, who's an Australian-bred horse by Star Kingdom, and he was a full brother to the very good Todman. And his racing career kind of really was, he was an older horse. He kind of was over the hill. Gene brought him over here, ran him a few, maybe a year or two, and didn't do anything, although he placed, and then stood him at his farm, which was called Verna Lee Farm in Arkansas. And what an incredible story that was, that from that Arkansas farm, Nohom became such an incredible stallion. Of course, you guys talked about No Double, which he had, but he was just an absolutely phenomenal stallion, and then ended up, I can't remember, I think he might have gone to Florida, I can't remember, but anyway, it was a great story, and it was, you know, an Australian bred stallion in this country, you know, which is kind of rare. And it was, you know, a really great success story.
And when we get to Arkansas, I've got about a 10-12 day period between Rebel and then the HPPA convention. We're going to get Dash on. He's going to tell that story. He did, if you heard the bits and pieces about how I said, what got your dad into racing? It sounded like tax avoidance.
Yeah.
was the motivation, which was hysterical. And so, you know, instead of bringing all this money, oil money back to the U.S., he bought a bunch of horses and brought them. That was a license to print more money.
that's really funny. And, oh, and you did mention Meadow Lake, too, which I wanted to...
Yes, yes.
Bertonier. Really, what a great trainer he was. And the thing with Meadow Lake... He actually picked Meadow Lake out as a yearling, and one of the reasons he did so was the physical resemblance to Secretariat. And if you ever saw Meadow Lake, there was a striking physical resemblance.
Hmm.
And another lightly raced horse,
yep.
You know, three races, I think he won his first race by like 22 lengths.
Yeah.
You know, and just an incredible time, six for a long time. And then of course, he won the Arlington Washington Futurity. And that was just an absolutely phenomenal performance. And at the time, you know, this horse was really being lauded as just an unbelievable horse. And I remember Bert Sonier saying at the time that best horse that he's ever, you know, one of the best horses he's actually seen, not just trained. And that's the kind of reputation Meadow Lake really did have at that time.
And went on to have a very, you know, very serviceable stallion career. I mean, he didn't become Danzig, but he got winners.
Yeah, I mean, he had a really good, you know, obviously the champion he got was Meadow Star, who was a phenomenal, you know, little filly.
You bet.
Yeah.
You bet. And was trying to think, there's somebody else that whose name a Meadow
Meadow Monster?
No, was Meadow Flight? Meadow Flight was Meadow Lake, right?
Yeah, I can't remember.
Meadow Flight, I think.
Back in time, I mean, I can't remember them all.
Meadow Flight, I'm almost positive was Meadow Lake. And was a real nice horse. That was mid-90s, give or take.
So. Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, he really was a solid racehorse, and he had. I remember at the time it was interesting because he had several winners in Japan too. When you know you weren't seeing a lot of these horses in Japan.
Well, Sid, we've got the train pulling out of the station when it comes to the three-year-olds. We're up and running. We didn't get a chance to talk yet about the three-year-old races, but we'll save them. We'll pile them up a little bit. That Smarty Jones winner, the Munnings son for McPeak, the Dash Attack. We'll get to that, and also the Jerome winner too for Kelly Brain, and that's another Tappet Courvoisier. So we'll save it up for next week. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely, Steve. Good talking.
Sid Fernando, Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale. And I also, the other thing I'm going to say for Sid is this column that he wrote that is in TDN this week in the Taking Stock column, which looks really interesting. There's also a wonderful picture of him with Leon Rasmussen, which is really cool. But it's a piece about Vaguely Noble in Cairo. So that I want to read, and I'll talk to Sid about it. Let's take a break here. Last of the morning. We're a little behind. We've got the visit with Nick Tamaro and Frank Hopp, Sam Houston Race Park, and they kick it off tomorrow. And undoubtedly, Nick is excited. We're excited for Nick. Frank's excited to have Nick. It's a mutual admiration session, I think, with Frank Hopp and Nick Tamaro next. Stay with us.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at pabred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our